Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we design, install, and maintain gardens in and around New York City. We Dig Plants aims to bring the culture to horticulture. And in doing so, we want to talk today about President's Day.
Of course.
We had to lump the two presidents together into 1 week, right, to make it President's Week.
That's right.
I think they made it the National Week to honor. Nobody cares. They just want the day off.
Right? Or they want the sales, you know.
That's right. It's really about washer and dryers and cars.
America.
Yes, exactly. But we're supposed to be celebrating our foundation and the personalities that help create our national identity, right,
right.
Alice?
Yes.
So that often gets missed. It's the tie to our agricultural history, to the land, and our reasons for its colonization. So we have an amazing guest today to help describe our founding fathers and our founding farmers.
That's right.
The gardeners that strove to cultivate our history and our mission.
Ba-dum-bum-bum.
Our guest today is garden historian from London, Andrea Wolfe. Her book, The Founding Gardeners, The Revolutionary Generation, Nature, and the Shaping of the American Nation, was published in 2011 by Knopf and has been a huge focus of us for several months now. Welcome, Andrea.
Hello.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Andrea's calling in from, are you in London?
I am in London, indeed, yes.
Well, that seems very appropriate that we're having this transatlantic conversation.
That's what's amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're actually having a very London-ish, wet, rainy, warm day here.
Yes.
Really? We had a very, very sunny, lovely blue sky day here today.
Oh,
wonderful. Well, I'd like to tell our audience a little bit about Andrea. Andrea Wolfe was born in India and moved to Germany as a child. She lives in Britain, where she trained as a design historian at the Royal College of Art. And her book, Founding Gardeners, went to number 32 on the New York Times bestseller list. And wasn't it also in the top 50 by the Kirkus Review? I think it was one of the top books of 2011,
yes.
Which is really quite an accomplishment.
It's a fascinating read.
Thank you.
She's written for the Sunday Times, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Garden, and Q Magazine, and reviews for several newspapers, including The Guardian, New York Times, The Times Literary Supplement, and The Mail on Sunday. She has also lectured widely to large audiences at the Royal Geographical Society and the Royal Society in London, the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, Monticello, and the Missouri Botanic Garden, amongst many others. She is a three-time fellow of the International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, and she is a regular contributor on BBC Radio and television. And she's also written several other amazing books as well. This Other Eden, The Brother Gardeners, and coming out this May, Chasing Venus, which is about Royal Society that sent out the ships to go measure and view the transit of Venus?
Exactly. So absolutely nothing to do with gardens. So I went from the earthly pleasures to the heavenly pleasures now.
That's great. So, Andrea, why did this American subject interest you? Tell us about that a little bit.
As a British woman.
Yeah.
Well, as a German who lives in Brittany, how dare I write about the American founding fathers? I think I came to it really by accident while I was researching my previous book, The Brother Gardeners, which is about the British obsession with gardens.
Right.
And one of the protagonists in The Brother Gardeners is John Bartram, who was an 18th century American farmer and plant collector who, from the early 1730s, for about four decades, sent hundreds and hundreds of seed boxes full of American plants, trees and shrubs mainly, to England and completely transformed the English landscape. And while I was doing research on him, it was really through his letters and his accounts that I realized this remarkable connection to the founding fathers.
Right.
So he'd been, for example, a very good friend of Benjamin Franklin. And as I kind of read on through diaries and manuscripts, I came across a visit of the delegates of the Constitutional Convention in 1787 to Bartram's Garden. There was an invoice to George Washington, who had ordered hundreds of trees and shrubs. John Adams had visited, Madison. Jefferson had even time to visit while he was writing the Declaration of Independence. So I thought that there's something going on I'm missing here.
Yeah.
And but it was only really when I followed Bartram's footsteps through the Appalachian Mountains that I realized just how important nature and plants had been for the Founding Fathers, because I was literally passing Charlottesville, and I thought, like, I'll just stop and have a look at Monticello, at the, you know, the home of the writer of the Declaration of Independence. And it was
just a quick
when
trip.
I went up to the mountaintop, and I was standing on the 1,000-feet vegetable terrace, that I just suddenly realized that this is the work of a revolutionary gardener who seemed to have crafted his grounds as carefully, really, as his words. And I think it's, I think when you're standing on that vegetable terrace and you see, you know, you see like neat rows of vegetables at your feet, but at the same time you see this kind of amazing, beautiful, vast landscape just kind of stretching out in front of you. That was for me the moment where I realized that this is something so uniquely American, this combination of the beautiful and the productivity of the land, I suppose. And that was the moment that kind of gave me the inspiration for this book, when I started to think, okay, I need to read a little bit more here. And I kind of, you know, went to their letters and realized that almost every letter they wrote, they mentioned somewhere, you know, trees, seeds, agriculture, the fields. I mean, the letters between Jefferson and Madison, for example, I don't think there's a single letter where they don't mention somewhere agriculture, plants, or trees. So it was very much part, very much kind of like their, on the top of their agenda, I suppose, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was lovely to read in your book about Jefferson's kind of British tour of the gardens in England, and how they influenced the design of Monticello and the positioning of a farm on a hill versus down in the valley, where it's much more pragmatic, where the water is, you know, he really...
It is weird, because if you look at Monticello, you're thinking, like, this is a bit crazy to put the, you know, the garden on top of the mountain where there's no water. And they're still struggling in dry summers to get the water up there.
Right.
But yes, it was. So it was Jefferson and Adams went on a garden tour in 1786. And at that time, Adams was the American minister in London, and Jefferson was the American minister in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And Adams had problems with the trade negotiations with the British, so he asked Jefferson to come over, who came, and then they were having real problems with their trade negotiations. And what else would you then do? You know, you go on a garden tour, but, you know, everything kind of gets stuck with kind of diplomatic relationships. You just go off. So they go on this big garden tour, and they go to several gardens, and what they see is they see what was very fashionable in England at that time. They see so-called ornamental farms. So these are gardens which combine really elements of a working farm with elements from a pleasure ground. So this is a garden where you would see shrubberies and flower beds, but you also see pastures and fields and sheep in the garden. And and again, it was this combination of the beautiful and the useful that very much appealed to them. So both of them, when they returned to America and when they started to create their gardens kind of much later, they incorporated these elements because it very much chimed with their vision of America as a country of vast lands that would feed the nation, but also of, you know, sublime beauty.
Right. And I love the opening chapters in your book where you're really describing Washington in the Revolution, and really where his head is back in
at his
Mount
farm.
Vernon,
yeah.
Trying to, you know, kind of figure out what plants he wants to plant.
Yeah, I have to say, when I came across there's one letter which really struck me as so extraordinary. So this is the summer of 1776, and George Washington is the commander in chief, and their headquarters are in New York, mm-hmm. and Manhattan has pretty much become, you know, an armed camp where there are soldiers in the street everywhere. And New York is facing 30,000 British troops. So this is the largest enemy fleet that has ever arrived at America's shores. And Washington has about half the manpower. So you would think that all he has on his mind really is military strategy, but a few days before the Battle of New York, which is one of the, you know, the biggest and most important battles in the War of Independence, he sits down in his headquarters. He kind of sends out his generals. He brushes aside his military maps, and he sits down and he writes a letter to his estate manager in Mount Vernon, asking him to design a new garden. So, mm-hmm. so you have this scene of, you know, there's like blood and the chaos of cannons is kind of looming, and Washington is actually thinking about trees and shrubs. And what's even more extraordinary is that at that moment, when the nation is, you know, is in danger to be crushed by the almighty British army, he is advising his estate manager to only plant Native American species. So he's telling him, go to my forest and pick up these plants and mm-hmm. these shrubs and plant them in my garden. Mm-hmm. So it's almost as if this is his horticultural declaration of independence. It's his private statement of independence. It's almost like he doesn't want to have an English tree clawing its roots into his soil in Mount Vernon. He only wants to have American trees. So it's a political statement, very much so, I think.
Yeah, there's a couple of quotes that I'd like to use from your book. Plantation owners, and one of them reads, plantation owners like Washington and Jefferson had no control over the sales of their own harvests, and they felt the pain of the economic chains. Washington had stopped growing tobacco and was trying to find alternatives in the hope that the new crops would break the dependence to Britain by supplying the home market in America instead. And his other quote is, Washington's other quote is, nothing, in my opinion, would contribute more to the welfare of the states than the proper management of our lands. So when you think about him as a commander in chief, and then you think about him as a gardener
and farmer
and a farmer, and then you think about him, you know, fighting and protecting our lands, that's the root of American ideology, I think, and democracy.
Yeah. Yes, it's that. I mean, I think we tend to sometimes forget that, but all of them, like Adams, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, all agreed that agriculture should be the foundation of America, and they very much saw America, or they very much understood that America's independence, political independence, would only function if it would be economically independent, and that
right.
would be very much based on agriculture,
yeah.
on being self-sufficient, and the that they were basically controlled by British merchants. You know, a lot of
yes.
kind of southern plantation owners didn't like that at all, obviously.
Right.
And
well,
I mean, Benjamin Franklin, for example, when he is in London just before the Declaration of Independence, he very much understands this too. And he sends, like, the more he believes that independence is inevitable, he starts to send like hundreds of seeds over, which might be useful in America. So
mm-hmm.
he's kind of frantically collecting possible, you know, useful crops from England to send them over to America to kind of try them out there. And they're always testing. And Jefferson very much believed that he says something like, the greatest service you can do for your country is to introduce a new plant, is to introduce a useful plant. And all his life, he's testing new species and discarding them if they're not good. So the vegetable terrace in Monticello is not so much to feed the family. It's much more his scientific lab where he's trying out new species of vegetables.
Yeah, a testing ground.
I visited it on a couple of occasions, and it's an extraordinary place. The house, the grounds, you can see the great mind at work there.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think what I find extraordinary is that we tend to see gardening as a kind of, you know, that's what we do in our leisure time. It's a pastime. It's a hobby. But for them, it's very much a political statement. So, for example, they're all obsessed with manure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just that when I kind of came across that, I thought, like, that's rather, you know, the first four presidents of the United States are totally obsessed with manure. And Washington, for example, is so enraptured by the subject that he wants a farm manager who, and he says, would Midas like convert everything he touches into manure
gold,
as the first transmutation towards gold.
Uh-huh.
And Adams, for example, jumps into a pile of manure in London and kind of like teases it apart. I mean, he is like not minding the muck on his hands, and then he's declaring, this is not equal to mine. You know, mine is much better. So for us, that might seem a little bit funny or something like this, but it's very much part of their political agenda, because the soil, especially in Virginia, where there's so much tobacco cultivation, is totally depleted. So in order to produce a lot of, you know, in order to have a good harvest, they need to do something with the soil. So they're constantly reading about, you know, the latest ways of improving soil by crop rotation, with manuring. So it's really part of their nation building agriculture.
Yeah. It's also fascinating. We're going to have to take a break in a second, but I once read a quote that actually, if the Dutch had kept the states, if there had not been the sale of Manhattan, right, that our whole idea of democracy and ideology would be completely different, I think.
Oh, I believe that.
Because the Dutch were such better farmers than the British ever were. And there's the constant comparison between, you know, the English garden and then, like you say, our founders, you know, comparing themselves to Britain and also to, you know, gardening procedures, you know what I mean? But yet
they are very frustrated about the way American gardening and farming works, and they are constantly, although, you know, America has declared independence, Washington, for example, is always in contact with English agricultural writers trying to get like the latest books, the latest information. He always wants to have European farm managers because they know much better how to kind of deal with the soil. So it's incredibly important for them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, we have to take a break for a second. Hang on to the line. Andrea will be right back, and then we'll talk about Washington and Mount Vernon, which is really fun.
This program was sponsored by White Oak Pastures. The Harris family has lived and farmed White Oak Pastures for 145 years. They are committed to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. Their mission? We take care of the land and the herd, and they take care of us. For more information about their cattle and their farm, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
America, sweet America. You know, God done shed his grace on thee. He crowned thy good. Yes, he did. Heavy brotherhood.
Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We're talking about President's Day, and we've got an amazing writer and garden historian who wrote a book called The Founding Gardeners. Andrea Wolf is on the line from
London.
So, Andrea, let's talk for a second about Mount Vernon, Washington's homestead, and the desire to Washington's desire to design it as a mirror of the revolution ideology, with native trees, the tearing down of hedges, a departure from the English style, an ornamental garden that would be planted with native species. Let's talk a little bit about that. We touched on it.
Yeah, so Washington, I mean, throughout the war, he only goes back once to Mount Vernon. But what he does is, what's really interesting, like once a week he will write a very long letter to his estate manager, and he'll also expect reports back. So stuff is happening there during the war. So he instructs his estate manager to kind of rip out certain bits of the garden and to plant native species. But it's really when he returns after the War of Independence that he totally redesigns the garden. So he comes back, he spends about a year sorting out, you know, his accounts and answering letters and stuff like that. And then it's almost so he comes back in December 83, and then it's exactly a year later, with the beginning of the new year, in January, which, you know, not the greatest month to start redesigining your garden.
And he's transplanting.
Soil is still frozen.
He's transplanting
and he's just,
trees.
You know, he's going out there, he's marking up trees, and he is creating these shrubberies, which are in front of the house around a big, you know, expanse of lawn, which he calls the bowling green. And around it, he plants these kind of irregularly planted shrubs and trees. All of them, entirely all of them, are Native American species. And for us, that might not seem that extraordinary today, but at that time, it is absolutely revolutionary what he's doing, because until then, American gardeners had tried to recreate the old world in their garden. So they're trying to recreate European gardens, English gardens. You know, your garden is the better, the more kind of European plants you have in the garden.
Right. And that was generally true
kind of
with
ripping them all out and replacing them with native species, which a lot of American gardeners would have almost regarded as weeds, because they're just, you know, out there, outside their garden gate. So why would you put that in your garden? And so he's creating what I would call the very first truly American garden. So he uses his garden almost like as a canvas to make this political statement. And the question is, you know, why is this important? I think it's important because he's making, obviously, a very deliberate choice there. And he knew, because he was the hero of the war, that Mount Vernon is going to be, you know, the most visited private house in the country. And the first thing that visitors would see who arrived at Mount Vernon was exactly that bit of the garden where he only plants the native species. So it's a big, big statement he's making now.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. I mean, if he's getting plants from Bartram and from other American collectors, I mean, Bartram was exporting tons of American species to England where they were exotic and you know, we're welcomed, right? And yet in our own backyard, American gardeners are still trying to be sort of referential back to Europe, not just in gardening taste, but in everything. Everything that was imported was better, right, Andrea? You know, cloth, food.
And I think the funny thing is actually that it was like when Jefferson and Adams went on their garden tour in England, that's when they suddenly realized that the English garden is almost entirely made up of American plants. And they go and say, like, oh, we can do this at home, but it can be a patriotic statement. So, but the interesting thing is that Washington, for example, in order to learn how to cultivate the American species, he had to read English garden books,
right?
Because there were no American garden books about how to look after American plants. So he's buying English horticultural publications to learn how to propagate American species. So it's this kind of weird loop that's going happening there.
Yeah. Let's talk about also some of the other founding gardeners. Let's talk about, there was a kind of a New England tour that happened between, among friends, James Madison and Jefferson, where they went up the Hudson River. And this was at a time when really the Federalists were becoming a very popular party, and then the Republicans were becoming, you know, a popular party. So it was like Hamilton and Adams and their strong central government and commerce with Britain ideology versus Jefferson and Madison that were much more of the mind state of the power of the states and individual liberty. So there's this kind of political brewing that goes on. And then there's this...
Yeah, so they go, in the summer of 1791, Jefferson and Madison go on this botanical tour, really, of the New England states. And so this is a time when Hamilton, who is the Secretary of the Treasury at that moment, is introducing kind of his financial plans for the 13 states, but he's also trying to establish very close commercial ties with Britain, right, which is something, and he's encouraging manufacturing, which is something that Jefferson and Madison didn't approve of at all. So they go on this New England tour, and what they're doing there is they're taking very extensive notes on agricultural practices. They also meet Republican supporters, so it's like a half botanical, half political tour. But what is even more extraordinary is that they are also they're looking at agriculture almost as a, you know, botanical weapon against,
exactly,
Hamilton's vision,
yeah,
of commerce.
Yeah.
Because they're really interested in sugar maples, the cultivation of sugar maple and the production of sugar from sugar maples,
mm-hmm,
because they believe that if American farmers would plant enough sugar maple orchards, America would not need to buy molasses from the British West Indies,
right,
which would then reduce the necessity to trade with the old enemy. So they talked to farmers, they talked to local landowners, and after the tour, Jefferson goes to the Prince's Nursery, which is on Long Island, and he buys every single sugar maple seedling that was available in the nursery, and then send them to Monticello to be planted there. So they were really trying to undermine Hamilton's vision of America as a merchant nation, and they were looking at America as an agricultural republic, and in that respect it was very important again to find useful crops. But the sugar maples were really used as a way to cut the ties, the commercial ties with Britain.
Right. Right.
Because even then we had an amazingly large sweet tooth, didn't we?
If
we can just reduce, now it's oil, you know,
yeah.
And then it was, if we could just reduce our dependence on molasses, we're going to be all right.
I like the quote from your book. The old friends observed the landscape as gardeners and plantsmen. They saw a republic of farmers spread out before them. A nation, to their mind, was endangered by Hamilton's plans. The scenery was one of meadows newly snatched from uncultivated nature and a mix of romantic wilderness and cultivated beauty. I thought that was a nice quote.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah,
also-
they always have this eye for the beautiful and the useful, which I think is it just comes through all of their writing, which for me is something very, very typical kind of American, which is very much also expressed in their gardens. They're always trying to combine these two. So they don't just want to create a kind of pretty garden. They are always useful elements incorporated. So, for example, Washington has, in the midst of his shrubberies, he has his toilets, and they are his outside privies, and he built them like little temples. Now, in England, if you'd walk down a shrubbery, you walk down this meandering path, you would end up, you know, it would end with a pavilion or a statue. But Washington puts his toilet there. So,
yeah,
you know, it's a beautiful shrubbery. It's a beautiful little temple, but it's also something useful.
Pragmatic, right.
And we have to remember, they're men of the Enlightenment, right, Andrew? I mean, there so many new things are coming through in science and medicine that, you know, they're just trying to keep up. You know?
Yes, and there, I mean, if you look at Jefferson's writing, I mean, he's such a polymath, and all of them are really, John Adams also, I mean, John Adams writes long botanical essays about seaweed, which are really boring to read, I have to say. But, you know, he's like investigating the different properties of different, you know, types of seaweed as manure. So they are very much looking at this also with a kind of scientific eye.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk for a second about, I love this pest. It's the scourge of heaven, or it's also called the Hessian fly.
The Hessian fly, yeah.
Which is analogous to the ungrateful colonies and the rebellious people. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, the Hessian fly was thought to have been brought over, that's why it's called the Hessian fly, in the straw beddings of the Hessian troops in the Revolutionary War, which it wasn't, but it was a really terrible pest, because it was a larvae of a fly that kind of sucked the sap from the green weed and stunted the growth of the plant and basically destroyed the crops. And it was, it had kind of started around New York, but it was spreading out really, really fast. So Washington was battling with it in Mount Vernon, and then years later it came all the way down to Virginia. And it became almost a political issue, because the English, in particular on the advice of Joseph Banks, who was the president of the Royal Society in London, closed their ports to American wheat, because they were worried that the Hessian fly would come into right. England through that. And Thomas Paine became involved, and he told Banks that he believed that this embargo was only a political maneuver, and Jefferson thought Banks was only doing that to injure the colony. So that it kind of goes back and forth, and then a former British prime minister basically believed that the Americans deserved the Hessian fly, because they had, you know, they had been so utterly ungrateful to the mother country.
That's what I love about it, is just this, you know, this idiosyncratic pest, and then it just takes on this, you know, unbelievable proportion of national political importance.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's talk also then about the idea of a national university and the adjacent botanical garden as a symbol of national unity, by George Washington, as men from across the differing states would study together and form friendships among a forest of different trees of America, which was the quote for the design of the National Arboretum.
Yeah, so, I mean, none of the first four presidents actually saw the National Botanical Garden kind of happening, but they all tried to get one going in Washington, D.C. The idea behind it was really, I mean, Washington's idea behind a national university was really that he said, okay, you know, there are these 13 states. We are together now, but we really have to mature from just being a war alliance to becoming a truly united nation. Mm-hmm. And you know, people from Virginia saw themselves as Virginians, not so much as Americans, and people
right.
from
South Carolina
saw themselves as kind of Southern. So there's this very. They sometimes, when they talk, for example, about plants, when Washington talks about plants from the New England states, he talks about exotics, because they are not native to Virginia. So we have to kind of bear in mind that, you know, these were 13 very different states, and they were suddenly kind of clumped together. And he believes that if you would bring these young men together at this kind of young age, studying together, learning together, they would become one, and they would have America's. They would kind of believe in America's destiny as a kind of united country. Mm-hmm. And the botanical garden should belong to the university, because if they would see all these trees from all 13 states growing together in kind of horticultural union, again, that would give them a sense of we are one country.
The symbol of, right, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think New Yorkers still see themselves as somewhat exotic. compared to the rest of the states.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, now, you know, to go from New England to South Carolina, it doesn't take very long. But then, you know, on horseback, how long did it, you know, how far could a man on horseback go, or even with a carriage? Yeah. 100 miles?
What? Not even.
You know, 70.
I mean, it took when Jefferson went from Washington, D.C. to Monticello, which now is a 2-hour drive.
Right.
Yes. That took him like 4 or 5 days.
Right.
That's what's astounding, that we, you know, these 13 colonies, which were a very large landmass relative to England, mm-hmm. for example. Right. I mean, when England has weather, it's pretty, you know, it's kind of like Italy. It's pretty small. It's a small area. It's the size of like Florida. So it's similar weather throughout most of the nation,
mm-hmm.
you know, and mm-hmm. there was radical differences and huge distances in this newly created nation. So it was very sort of forward thinking and amazing that Washington and the other founders would, you know, think about doing this right away. Don't let it sort of fall apart. You know what I mean? We have to glue it together quickly.
Well,
you know?
From sea to shining sea, you know, let's jump forward and talk a little bit about Thomas Jefferson, July 1803, and Meriwether Lewis's journey across the United States on the heels of the Louisiana Purchase.
Yeah,
right?
That was a massive expansion as well, of course.
So the tour was to document, among other things, the soil and the face of the country, its growth and the vegetable production. And Meriwether Lewis was instructed by Jefferson to use the paper of the birch tree as notepaper, which would protect against dampness in the field. And he was to record the dates of particular plants, when they flower, when they're in leaf, you know, etc. And all of this was to gain information, which was actually more important than seeing the Pacific Ocean, Jefferson asserted. And should conflict be evident, Meriwether Lewis was instructed to retreat in order to protect the information that he had obtained. So really, it was to discover profitable crops, flowers with exotic shapes and sizes, and trees that could soar higher than those already encountered. So this is really the American glorification of all this vast wilderness. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Lewis and Clark expedition for Jefferson, it was incredibly important because it was doing two things. It's one thing is, if you believe in an agrarian republic, the one thing you really need is a lot of land, because when the country expands, when you have more and more farmers, you need more land. And they truly believed that the kind of independent farmer with their small self-sufficient farms, that they were the foot soldiers of the nation. So in that respect, it was incredibly important. But it's also the kind of first scientific expedition for the Americans to put together. And when you read Jefferson's instructions to Lewis, it is really a blueprint of Enlightenment thinking, all the things he instructs him to do. But when Lewis comes back and when he kind of describes what he's seen, it's almost like as if the kind of the shriveled little seeds kind of held the possibilities of a bright future in them. And it was really the beginning of the celebration of America's wilderness, because until then, I mean, colonists had seen the American wilderness, almost, it was a hindrance, it was an obstacle to settlement, it was something annoying, it was not something to celebrate. And it was really through, the America's nature became part of the national identity, became part of being one country. It was because the Americans had to find something that was better in the new world than in the old world, because mm-hmm. Europe had ancient ruins and poetry and all these kind of things, and America was such a young nation, they had to find something that was better, and they found that in the spectacular landscape where everything was bigger and better, the trees were higher, the mountains were higher, it was vaster, and that became very much part of a kind of expression of this young, strong new nation.
Mm-hmm. Yep, as strong as the mountains. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Andrea, we're out of time. I recommend that everybody read this book. It is just fascinating. It's called Founding Gardeners. Andrea Wolf, again, is the author, and she was our guest today. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrea.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And the book is so descriptive of our identity, so many facts and anecdotes of seeds and trees and natives and plant material.
It should be required reading.
It should be. Absolutely.
I'm going to put it on my son's reading
list. Oh, I would like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to suggest it at my son's school.
Yeah. And you'll never think of our American story as simply a story of how the West was won. It's a much different perspective and a real sensitivity towards the landscape and the plants that we offered to the world, basically. It's a lovely book. Thank you so much for writing it.
Well, thank you.
And for joining us today. So we're going to post a link to your website, Andrea, for President's Day. And maybe people will pay attention to something more important rather than the sale of washers and dryers.
Well, I would like to thank Carlos Seguero for producing and engineering our show today, and to Roberta Speetz in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and to our sponsor. If you miss any part of the show, please note it is available via archive on the website, heritageradionetwork.com, and via podcast at iTunes. Please leave comments and or join our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc., We Dig Plants, and on Twitter, We Dig Plants. And also visit our gardening website, groundworksgardens.com. See you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.